All right. Good evening. We are speaking about Assyrian tonight, but I'm like a Sephardi-Yekki, so like I'm definitely not going to start Syrian time. I got invited over to a wedding at Achiezer, which is one of like the big Syrian synagogues in Brooklyn on Ocean Parkway, and like the wedding invitation said 7:30. I got there, you know, what I thought in perfect time, 8 o'clock. The wedding did not start until an hour later. So that is not how tonight is going to be. I'm very, very, you know, I think it's because I'm 3/4 Ashkenaz, so I apologize to begin with. Oh, what?
I have
2 times. Oh my gosh, that's the way to do it. You got to do 2 times. Oh, that's fantastic. So tonight's shiur, just a couple of things. There was a Talmid Chacham that I knew personally who very unfortunately passed away a couple of weeks ago. His name is Rabbi Eliezer Yaakov Ben Shmuel Pinchas. Passed away, so I'd like to dedicate tonight's shiur. The Torah learning that we're going to learn tonight hopefully should be a aliyah for his nefesh, Bezrat Hashem. The second thing is a lot of the shiur is based on an amazing, amazing shiur that was given by a rabbi. His name is Rabbi David Sutton. Rabbi David Sutton, he lives in Brooklyn, also on Ocean Parkway. Very interesting individual. His father-in-law is Nassan Sherman. Who's Nassan Sherman? Nassan Sherman is the head of ArtScroll, the CEO of ArtScroll. Very, very, very important personality. You might even argue that he's one of the most important personalities in terms of spreading Torah nowadays. And there's a whole question in terms of what sort of Torah, in terms of what sort of stuff is ArtScroll taking out. Don't worry, we will talk all about this because it most certainly does come up. But I have a tremendous amount of Hakarat HaTov for the shiur that he gave. He has a whole series that's fantastic. I highly, highly suggest it. Okay. Now we'll start. So by now you guys should know very, very much, especially those people who have been the people of the book for a few years already, my great, great affinity for Rav Avad Yosef. For 2 years when I was learning in Kolel, in Gris Kolel in Yerushalayim, in Bayit Vegan, I used to jump onto the 72 bus, I remember 73 bus, go to Har Nof, to 45 at Kablan, and go to Rav Avadia's house every single Masei Shabbat for 2 years. It was absolutely amazing. And during those 2 shiurim that we gave over here, we gave 2 shiurim on Rav Avadia. I could have given 100, but on those 2 shiurim, probably better for you guys, it wasn't 100, but basically, during those 2 shiurim, we mentioned a very, very famous story. Very, very famous story. If you would go up, if you would do like Jay Leno, even though he doesn't do this anymore, if you would be like Jay Leno, be like man on the street, and ask people and say, hey, like, what do you know about Ezra Atiyah? The one story people would tell you is that one time, Rav Avadia's father, his name was Yaakov, what I find to be tremendously funny, there was a new biography that was just published by ArtScroll, fantastic, about Rav Avadia. It continues referring to his father as R. Yaakov, as in Rabbi Yaakov. His father was not a rabbi, as we discussed many, many times. He loved going to different weddings every single night. He was a mishorer. He was a shopkeeper, but he was definitely was not a Talmid Chacham. He didn't really know any Torah at all. And in fact, he really couldn't even appreciate why his son, Rav Avadia, loved Torah. So much so illustrated by this story. That what happened was, Rav Avadia is learning very assiduously in yeshiva. And what happens is that Rav Yaakov, I know I just said Rav Yaakov, and Yaakov is having a hard time in his store. See, our school is influencing it. Having a hard, hard time in his store. And he needs the help in the store. So he asks his son, Rav Avadia, to come and spend a few hours. Rav Avadia comes for a few days, and he's there. He's at the store. Rav Ezra Atiyah, the very person on the screen over here, Rav Ezra Atiyah, the Rosh Yeshiva, the venerated Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Prat Yosef, the premier Sephardi institution in Eretz Yisrael and the entire world, came. And he said, Yaakov, what are you doing? Don't you realize what your son can be? Do you have any idea what sort of gadol he could be? Yaakov said, but I need someone in my store. Sorry, I need someone in my store. So Ezra Atiyah went and he took an apron and he put it around him and he said, I will work for you. I will work for you. Instead, if you let Rav Avadia go back to yeshiva, if you let him come with me, and it's not exactly what happened. They actually said, it's a funny story. I mean, ArtScroll changed it also. But Rav Avadia actually went back to work at the store again. And what happened was, people started stealing stuff from the store, but Rav Avadia was very much into his learning. So his father's like, better for you to be in yeshiva, get out of here. So I want to talk about, who was this Rav Ezra Atiyah? This great, I mean, we can already see from the story how tremendously humble he was. One of the greatest rabbis of his generation. Someone that, when he would walk into a room, the Chazon Ish, the quintessential Ashkenazic gadol from the last generation. If I were to ask you, it's probably a 1A and 1B between like the Brisker Rav and between the Chazon Ish, if we were going to say great Lithuanian Gedolim. The biggest Lithuanian Gadol used to stand up for him when Ezra Atiyah used to walk into a room. So who was this great rabbi? So Bezrat Hashem, hopefully tonight, by the end of tonight, we will know a lot more about Rav Ezra Atiyah. But in order to know Rav Ezra Atiyah, you have to know about Aram Sova. You have to know about Aleppo. Ah, what an interesting place. already in the Torah, already in Shmuel Aleph, already in Divrei Yamim, there's already a few references to this area called Aram Sova. Very, very interesting. What exactly is Aram Sova? David HaMelech goes up there and, you know, conquers and does stuff up in Aram Sova. That's the context over there. He fights wars. There is a tradition. There is a tradition amongst the Syrian Jews that Aram Sova is Aleppo. If you notice all the way up to the north, that's Aleppo. Aram Sova is Aleppo. And that's a little bit crazy. Because, like, if you notice Israel's all the way down here, I mean, how exactly is that? I mean, it's pretty far. In fact, the Rambam and Rashi and the Ma'ariv Kolon all say that it's impossible that Aram Sova could be the exact same thing as Aleppo. It just can't be. Because Aleppo is way too far north. In fact, there's a book that was published by this person, David Sutton, published by ArtScroll, called Aleppo, City of Scholars, where it brings a very, very interesting, it's not a Midrash in the slightest, that says that Yoav ben Tseruya, who was one of the officers of David HaMelech's army, went up there to go fight Amalek, because Amalek was all the way up north. He was fighting Amalek, and what did he do before leaving? He built a shul there, and that shul ended up being the main shul of the Aleppo Jewish community. I mean, there's a professor at Bar-Ilan, his name is Dr. Tzvi Zohar, very, very interesting person. He's written all about giraffes, he's absolutely amazing, he's incredible. I mean, the shul should get him here. So Tzvi Zohar wrote an entire critical essay against this book, Aleppo City of Scholars by David Sutton. And within that, he shows there's absolutely no biblical source. He shows there's no midrashic source. He shows there's no historical source that shows that Aleppo is the same thing as Aram Sova. It's really just not. Only starting from the 11th century, people are writing to the scholars in Egypt. How do we know this? From the Cairo Geniza. People are writing to scholars in Egypt from Aleppo and saying, oh, we are in Aram Sova. But only from the 11th century. Not to mention, I mean, this is just a different story, Aleppo already existed basically, I don't know, 300 CE. Already way, 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 no, not CE, of the Common Era, BCE. Before the Common Era. Way before, in terms of it's a ridiculously, ridiculously, ridiculously old town, which, like, it was never, ever under the dominion of Aram Sova. It's just way too far north. But that's not really what I want to focus on. What's more important about anything is that they themselves viewed it that Aram Sova is the same thing as Aleppo. Like, I don't really care what exactly the historical facts are, but the very fact that they believed that they had this biblical link to where Yoav was, to where this army of David HaMelech was, they felt it to be very, very important, and they viewed themselves to be important by the fact that there's that type of linkage. So that's just a, I don't know, it's like an interesting historical thought. Very interesting. But this place Aleppo, even though it's not, I mean, if you're leaving tonight, Aleppo is not Aram Sova, Aleppo's north, but in Aleppo, it was a very, very, very scholarly town, very much so. So much so that already in the 900s, you have Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon visited it, and he came out and he said, wow, like, this town really is totally full of scholars. It's really beautiful. The Rambam writes something very interesting. The Rambam says that the Jews were very, very acculturated there. He writes that they used to sit and listen to music. I mean, this is already during the 12th century, which is really interesting, that they used to sit in cafes and, like, listening to music, and that they used to, you know, hang out at coffee shops and talk to non-Jewish people. Like, that's basically unheard of at that time in Jewish history. It's really, really, really interesting. Another small thing is that Rav Ovadia Hager, who shows up so often in the writings of the Rambam had this one follower who loved him. His name is Rav Ovadia Hager. The most famous thing about Rav Ovadia Hager is that he wrote a letter to the Rambam, which is, like, some people say the Rambam is intellectual, he's so cold, but he writes his letter and he says, I'm a ger, and certain people are telling me, including a rabbi, that I shouldn't be able to say, you know, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. I shouldn't be able to say all this. I shouldn't be able to talk about, you know, Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoteinu, are my forefathers, because my forefathers were non-Jewish. That's what he's writing the Rambam. And you can see he's very, very, very pained by that. Very pained by that. So the Rambam writes one of the most beautiful letters, very, very famous response, where he says, no, 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 no. By the very fact that you come from Avraham Avinu, by the very fact that you decided to come under Kanfei HaShechina, by the very fact that you wanted to become Jewish, you are way better. And the Rambam's like, you could tell that rabbi to, you know, to shut it. Like, in terms of like, the guy's totally wrong. You are a tzaddik and you are absolutely amazing. Another interesting thing about Aleppo, which will come up later, is that the Keter Aram Sova is very famous. There was a book that came out a few years ago by a person, I think his first name, Shama Friedman, I think, if I'm not mistaken, one of the Friedmans. He wrote a whole book all about the Aleppo Codex. That's excellent. You know about the Aleppo Codex. The Aleppo Codex was a version of Tanakh. At one point it was totally full, which is written by the very famous Ben Asher family from Tveria. It's known to be the most accurate biblical text that we have. The most accurate text that we have. And a lot of the things that we might have are a little bit different. We actually have a member of our community. Her name is Dr. Dina Grant. She works at Barry University. She gave a tremendous shiur about this a couple years ago. Really, 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 really tremendous. I highly suggest this book about the Aleppo Codex. Very interesting. So this codex went all the way. The Rambam himself used it when he checked his own Sifrei Torah, and then eventually ended up in Aleppo. In the town, they guarded it zealously, so much so they didn't allow anyone to take any sort of photostat. They wouldn't let anyone see it. And in fact, even nowadays, and this is important, a lot of these people that descended from these original Aleppans carry within their wallets pieces of the Keter Aram Sova, which is absolutely priceless historically, but they view it to be, which is funny because the Rambam was a great rationalist, but they're holding on to it as like some sort of, you know, some sort of talisman, which is very interesting. So due to a garrison in Aleppo, there was a garrison, a standing army all the time in Aleppo. It was very, very, very prosperous. People used to go there. It was a major, major center of trade. And like most times in Jewish history, Jews benefited from it like you wouldn't believe. Very, very, the Jews of Aleppo became very, very wealthy. Very, very wealthy. Because of all this trade, you didn't have like this feeling of like working is negative. And we're going to see this very much as we move on. That like working is very good. In fact, many of the great chachami, many of these great rabbis, in addition to just holding rabbinic jobs, they also worked, which was a very, I mean, as we're going to see, especially modern day Haredi society, that's like a major, major, you know, bone of contention. But one major thing that they always did was always give tzedakah to their chachamim. That was like a big deal. They always take, whether it's maaser, whether it's giving 20%, they would always give money to their chachamim. That was something that they were very, very, very proud of. Very proud of. So the Aleppan Jewish community grew by leaps and bounds. Eventually it was taken over by the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century. And then what happened was, this is fascinating because it changes. Oh, this is the book, before I go on. Oh, sorry, before I even go on. There's a great book that I actually have over here. It's called Aleppo Tales by Chaim Sabato. So if you want to get an insight into what their culture is like, Chaim Sabato is a Rosh Yeshiva at Maale Adumim. Really amazing. He's mainly known nowadays for this sefer that they're actually translating into English as we speak, which is Mevakshei Panecha, where Chaim Sabato had a whole bunch of conversations with Rabbi Dr. Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal, and really, really out of this world. I mean, there's a picture of Bibi Netanyahu sitting in the Knesset, and you know he's supposed to be listening to people, but he's not. He's like reading this book instead, which is pretty cool. So this book really does a great job, and he's really Chaim Sabato. He's famous for writing another book, which is also called Adjusting Sights, where that book is called Kivun Teomim. It won like the Israeli equivalent of like the Pulitzer Prize. So he's known. He's awesome. He's like a poet. He's like a big Talmid Chacham. Loves Torah, but also like writes amazing, amazing fiction. So, the Aleppan Jewish community, oh, this is the book I wanted to tell you about. City of Scholars by Our Scroll by Rabbi David Sutton. Is this book historically reliable? We will see over and over and over again that it's not in the slightest. It's a nice coffee table book, you know, $49.99 at ourscroll.com. Very good book. I might own it, but it's a very, very good book, but not historically accurate at all. A lot of it has to do with the publisher, as we will discuss. The Spanish Inquisition in 1492, changed a lot. It changed the face of Aleppo. Before then, Aleppo was very much a society which, you know, everyone was Syrian, and everyone, you know, they all held by these Syrian minagim. Already, you have so many people fleeing to this Torah center from Spain. So you end up with these very famous names like Dayan, Lanyado, Harari, Katzin, Pinto, Silvera, Antibi, and Atia. These are very, very famous Spanish names, where they all came to this community. Originally, there was a little bit of strife because all of these Spanish exiles are coming with their own customs, and already the Syrian Aleppian Jews have their own customs, but eventually they found shalom, and because really, you know, they loved Torah so much, it really became that, like, the cream really rises to the top. So it didn't really matter if you were really from Syrian origin, from Spanish origin, really, you know, the leaders became, you know, really people who came from Spain. But the leaders became those top Talmidei Chachamim that it really was. A forefather of Rav Ezra Atiyah was a great rabbi. His name was Chacham Shem Tov Atiyah. He was a contemporary of the Beit Yosef in Eretz Yisrael. Another forefather of Rav Ezra Atiyah actually gave up his life during the Inquisition. So after the Ottoman conquest of 1517, trade links were forged in Turkey, Persia, India. I mean, you might ask, like, I actually have, like, a Sefer Torah, which belongs to, like, our family that, like, went through Calcutta, through one family of ours that, like, we know very, very well. How did all of these Jews end up there? A lot of this had to do with the Ottoman Empire. These huge centers of trade, Jews were trusted very, very much. We already spoke in previous Shiurim about how amazing the Ottoman Empire was to the exiles. Bazayid II, the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, actually sent ships to Spain in 1492 to go bring these exiles and really start this, start this society of, like, people who are really smart and really good, and, like, they helped the Ottoman Empire tremendously. Now, I just also want to keep in mind, not everything was so rosy. I have a great book. Also, Syrian Jewry in Transition. We're going to skip a few centuries, 1840 to 1880. There, unfortunately, were three major blood libels that went on in Syria between this time. Not as famous as the Damascus blood libel, where Sir Moses Montefiore got involved, and it was really the first time Jews, worldwide Jewry, flexed their muscle and really, you know, was able to get the Jews that were accused out. It's a fascinating chapter in Jewish history. Really sad, obviously. But it wasn't always so great. But most of the time in Aleppo, things were really, really, really good because of all of the money people were making, and things were awesome. So there was a general idea. Oh, here we go. In the Ottoman Empire, they saw already by the 19th century, things were going downhill. So they started a whole reformation project called the Tanzimat, where they tried reforming education, they tried reforming their army, and they tried reforming their economy. And it did not go particularly well. It's very interesting, but you end up having this groups, many groups, coming from Europe and trying to teach the Ottoman Empire, like, technology, trying to teach them everything, basically. So one of these groups was this thing called Alliance Israelite Universelle, which really comes from France. The Beni Shai, The Beni Shai was from Iraq. His name was Rav Yosef Chaim of Baghdad. He fought against the Alliance. He was born in 1833, passed away in 1909. So he fought against the Alliance because they viewed them as coming, you know, interlopers who are trying to basically take away religion and taking away from the Torah-only attitude that was in Iraq. In Syria, it wasn't like that at all. As we mentioned before, they didn't view work with disdain, and they didn't say that a person has to be Torah-only. So therefore, when the Alliance came and opened these schools, the Chachamim were very, very into it. And the Chachamim sent even their own children to the Alliance schools. That was a very big deal, because if you would take a look at that book by Rabbi Sutton, it doesn't mention any of that. In fact, what it says is that the great Rabbanim actually fought against the Alliance schools. That's not historically true in the slightest. What did happen is that beginning really with the late 19th century, early 20th century, the Alliance schools started neglecting Torah, and then you actually have some sort of, you know, opposition. But before then, they were welcomed, you know, enthusiastically, very much so. They were big believers in Pirkei Avot, in Perek Bet, Mishnah Bet. It says, Yafet Tamut Torah im Derech Eretz, Shigia Shneem Mishakacha Davon. It's good to combine Torah with a worldly occupation, for the effort involved in both makes one forget sin. And the next line is even stronger. It says, V'chol Torah She'ein Imah Melacha, any Torah that doesn't have work along with it, Sofa Betila V'Gureret Davon. What's going to happen is it's going to fail, and it's going to lead to sin. That you need to actually be a worldly person involved in other occupations. So Rav Ezra Atiyah, let's talk about Rav Ezra Atiyah. Rav Ezra Atiyah was born in 1887 to a scholarly and illustrious family. However, dirt poor, very, very poor. They got money from some of the Tamidich, from some of the great Givirim, from some of the great, rich people in Syria. But like their family were such great tzaddikim, they always gave it out. They were very, very, very poor. They had a very, very difficult time of having children. I'm sure it was related. So many miscarriages. He actually had two older siblings, a brother named Yaakov and a sister. I don't know her name. I mean, it doesn't really record it. So very, very, very poor, and unfortunately having lots of miscarriages. So she's having a very hard time having kids. So they went over to the grave of Ezra HaSofer. There's a little bit of a problem with this. There's actually two graves of Ezra HaSofer. It's kind of like, you know, the original cross. Like, you know, I don't know. It was like, for as much wood, you know, you could probably build like a Noah's Ark with that. But like, Ezra HaSofer has really two different, what's it called? He really has two different graves. One grave is in Basra, Iraq. That's actually the Ben Ish Chai. You know, he subscribed to that very much, that it was there. But there was another tradition that Ezra HaSofer was really buried over here, right next to Aleppo, really 2 miles out of Aleppo. And what happened was is that his mom went over to the kever and was crying on the kever and said, "Ezra HaSofer, please pray to Hashem that if I have a child, I will dedicate that child to Torah and only Torah, and I will name the child after you." Like most of these stories go, and obviously his name is Ezra, as most of these stories go, she ended up 9 months later having a child. She named her kid Ezra, and that was it. Father was very, very poor and said, "Hey, we'll try our luck." The Gemara says that, you know, shinoi makom, shinoi mazal, we'll change our place, maybe our luck will change. And they moved to Yerushalayim. They moved to Yerushalayim. However, it really wasn't much better there. Oh, I forgot to add one small thing, which is amazing. This is out of this world. In Halab, Halab is the Arabic name for Aleppo, for that area. His charuta was a great tzaddik, a forgotten tzaddik that hardly anyone even knows about. His name was Matlub Abadi. Now, I know him because I learned Yoredeya. Yoredeya is all the laws of kashrut. So he's very famous for writing a teshuvah where he has 9 reasons why you could have a dishwasher for meat and milk and wash them at the exact same time. And I'm Sephardi. I'm like, that's awesome. I would love to do that. But my... awesome! Oh my gosh! So, I don't know, my Catholic builder who like made our kitchen was like, "No, like you should just do it now, because if you ever want to sell, you know, if you ever want to leave Boca," I don't know why I ever would. I mean, obviously you're at Eretz Yisrael, but you know, if you ever want to sell the house, make 2 dishwashers so we keep both. Don't worry, everyone here could eat at my house. It's not a problem. But Rav Matlul Avadi, he writes that dishwashers are absolutely okay. It's not a problem in the slightest to put both together. A lot of it has to do with the halacha principle of something that's disgusting, that most people would never eat. You know, stuff that goes into dishwashers, absolutely disgusting. Ramosha Feinstein does not agree with this in the slightest, even though his son Rav David does disagree with him, but it's very interesting. The other thing he's very famous for, that he was chavrutas chavruta, I apologize. Am I the only Sephardi in this room? His chavruta was... what was Rav Ezra Atiyah. They learned together. Rav Ezra Atiyah already was so great. He was so amazing. His teacher said, "There's nothing I can teach you." So instead, he just learned with Rav Matlub. The other thing that he's famous for, and I wrote it over here, there's a great rabbi. His name, he's interesting, very interesting. You can actually find his videos on YouTube, which like I love. I'm kind of a loser. I apologize. Like, you know, I like, that's what I watch instead of, you know, even though I watch the Golden State Warriors, that's okay. But, I'm from California. So what happens is that his name is Rabbi Josef Faur. Rabbi Dr. Josef Faur. He learned in Lakewood. He was so close to Rav Aaron Cutler that he was one of the few that was chosen to carry Rav Aaron Cutler's coffin. Eventually, he moves away from it and he asks Rav Matlub, "What should I do?" And Rav Matlub tells him, he says, "You go ahead and become a professor at JTS, the Jewish Theological Seminary." And he was a teacher there for years and years and years. In fact, what I produced over here for you guys, don't worry, it's just for fun. If you guys take a look at page 3, there is a letter from Rav Matlub defending Josef Faur, telling everybody that he is Yirei Shamayim, and what he's doing at the seminary is doing amazing things and keeping them from doing all sorts of other things, and he's doing a great job, and he's giving shiurim at a shul in Brooklyn called Achiezer that people were picketing. So Rav Matlub writes this beautiful, beautiful thing. And there's another longer one. Mark Shapiro actually put this online, which I'm very thankful for. You guys know Evan Shapiro's brother. Really, really, really interesting. Rabbi Dr. Faur actually left the seminary in the early 80s. Him and Dr. Weiss Halivni, they left when they started ordaining women because he was very, very against that. Now he's a professor in Israel. Very, very interesting person. I highly suggest his YouTube videos. He's very funny. Like, he's hilarious. Like, he wears, like, a black shirt. Like, he doesn't look, like, yeshivish at all. And, like, he's speaking. Oh, man, I'm telling you. I'm like, in heaven. I love it, even though I'm wearing a white shirt right now. So that's what he's famous for. So in 1901, they moved to Yerushalayim. And things are not better. They are so poor. They are so poor that their doorknob breaks. And in order to protect their house from intruders, every single night they would perch on top of the door, and it was like a video, it's like a hilarious YouTube video, but basically they would go ahead and put on a bucket, so if anyone would come in, the bucket would be their alarm. I mean, that's how poor they were. It was really, really, really bad. Really bad. Oh, sorry, just to go back about Rav Matlub. I gotta talk about Rav Matlub. I'm so sorry. There's a great rabbi, his name was Rabbi Yehuda Abbas, from the very famous Addis family. They also came from Spain way back in the day. So he was one time walking in Brooklyn, and he was talking to another rabbi, and someone ran over to him and said, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. Rav Addis, you knew both Rav Ezra Atiyah and you know Rav Matlub. Which one of them are greater? Which one of them are better? Which one of them was the greater Tamid Chacham? So the other person he was talking to got so upset. He said, you? Who are you? You barely keep Shabbat. You look at you, you're not even wearing a kippah right now. And you're asking right now who's bigger, of Matlub or of Ezra Atiyah? Who do you think you are? So Rav Addis got very upset. He said, no, Assyrians, we have it in our blood. For him, these people are like, you know, I'm like baseball players. Like, he loves his Rebbeim so much, he really just wants to know more about them, and it's really, really beautiful. Even though he's not necessarily a practicing, you know, he's not practicing Orthodoxy, nevertheless, he loves it so much. Really, really do. I hope you guys enjoy that story. Okay, so basically, they moved to Yerushalayim. They're very, very poor. Very, very, very poor. And his father actually passes away, like right when they get there. And it's really bad, because his father, according to the stories, his father could have been cured if they would have had enough money, but they didn't have enough money. And what happened was, Rav Ezra starts, you know, getting depressed. He says, if only I had been working, if only I had become, at one point he was supposed to be a carpenter, if only I was going to go get work, then my father would still be alive. His father came to him in a dream and said, oh, son, Rav Ezra, don't be upset. Don't be upset at all. Put yourself to Torah. That's the most important thing. Don't feel bad about the very fact that, you know, that I died. It was my time. So that gave him closure. That gave him closure. But Ezra Atiyah was learning 18 hours a day, and he only subsisted on one pita for the entire day. And if they were very lucky, they got eggs. Like one egg, one hard-boiled egg. He would share it with his mother. He would actually continue this for the rest of his entire life. For his whole life, he just subsisted on just one pita, and like that was it. Like, he didn't do, and he wasn't like into eating stuff at all. So Rav Ezra thought about joining the workforce, but why did he not? Because his mom. So he actually went to become a carpenter, and he was like sitting there, like learning how to be a carpenter. His mom runs in there, grabs him out, and says, I didn't go to Ezra's kever. I'm not working myself ragged in order so that I have a son that's a carpenter. No way. You are going to become a Tamid Chacham, and that's it. Learning only. She was so dedicated. There's a halakha in Masechet Shabbat that's really, I mean, I love this story. If I tear up, I apologize. What happened was, is that the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat says that a person is not allowed to read by the light of an oil lamp. What would be the problem with it? The Gemara says, Shema Yateh. The problem is that once already a lot of the oil, you know, basically is Moshech, once already is going into the wick, what a person is going to do to prolong the light will go ahead and tip it and therefore cause more oil to burn, which would end up being the Melacha of Havara on Shabbat, and that would be totally, totally Asur. So, in order to get around this, the Gemara says, you need to have a Shomer, or in our case, a Shomeret. You need to have someone to watch to make sure that while a person's so involved in their learning, they're not going to go ahead and by accident go and yateh and lean the lamp and turn it over so that it will, you know, so it will give them more light. So Ezra Atiyah's mom, she used to work herself ragged, cleaning houses, cooking stuff, doing amazing stuff day and night. Friday night, the one thing she wants her son to do is sit and learn Torah. So she's sitting there. And Rav Ezra Atiyah is sitting and learning by the lamp. she would nod off. Rav Ezra would close his Gemara. He would wait there for his mom to wake up. The second his mom would wake up, pop it open again. Many times he said, Ima, you're so tired, just go to bed. She said, no, I'm doing all this for you. I'm doing everything so that you become a big, big Talmid Chacham. What's so amazing is that Ezra said that, like, that type of Mesirut Nefesh, that type of, you know, that type of work that his mom put towards him becoming such a great tzaddik really pushed him to become such a great, great person. I mean, he never said about himself he was a great person. So money was very much an issue. So one time, he's like walking the streets, and there was a great rabbi who heard that he was so poor. His name was Chacham Ezra Raful. Very wealthy, and he said, from now on, and Rav Ezra is already 18 at this time, he said, from now on, I will pay for everything for you. I want it to be like Yisachar Zvulun. I want to give you money. You learn, and then I will support you. That's exactly what happened. And every single time that Rav Atiyah would meet one of the Raful family, he would actually go ahead and say that my Torah, you know, echoing Rabbi Akiva, my Torah is because of your family. My Torah is because of you. He was actually able to sit and learn very, very well. An interesting thing is that one of his great-grandkids, Rav Yosef Harari Raful, is one of the members of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah of the Agudas Israel. He's a very interesting person. He's like the token Sephardi, like part of it. He's the head of Ateret in Brooklyn. Something interesting that he says, just to know about this, because, you know, sometimes you hear certain things from the Agudas Israel, he says that you cannot do Mitzitza B'peh. He says you cannot do Mitzitza B'peh. There's a whole thing during the Brit Milah in terms of suction. It's a whole discussion. But basically, he says that you have to use a tube. Absolutely don't at all go ahead and do it. He thinks it's a major sakana. I find that to be interesting, because it really goes against what the Agudas Israel publicly came out and said. All right, now able to learn, Rav Ezra applied himself even more. But had he become really, really well known? So, the great rabbis, and this is something that, like, us Ashkenazim, like, I'm a 3/4 Ashkenaz, so I could say us also, but basically us Ashkenazim don't know so much about the great Sephardi Gedolim. So one of these great Sephardi Gedolim that was living in Yerushalayim at the time, his name was Rav Yedid HaLevi. And he asked the question one time at his house. All the great scholars were there, and he asked, crazy kushya, a question that no one could answer. And everyone's giving answers, and he's shooting them down, and he's like, oh, come on, man. No one can give me an answer. And Ezra's sitting all the way in the back, and you can picture like a movie, sitting all the way in the back, and he says, I think I have an answer. And he gets up and he says the answer. Rav Yedid HaLevi says, no, you're wrong, and he gives him an answer. That's what he does. However, at this convocation of great rabbis, was a great rabbi named Rav Shlomo Lanyado. His name will be important later because he's going to be the first Rosh Yeshiva Purat Yosef. So he was there and he said, whoa, I've heard that answer before. Where have I heard that answer before? I've heard it in a sefer called Mishmoret Keuna. It's a very, very obscure sefer. And in the sefer, if you would open it up, it asks the question that Rav Yedid asked. It has the answer that Rav Ezra Atiyah says. Then it says at the end, even though this answer is not great, it's the best answer there is. When Rav Yedid heard this, he said, oh my gosh, who is this person here that gave the same answer as the Mishmoret Keuna? And that's really when Rav Ezra Atiyah became Rav Ezra Atiyah. Like, everyone knew about him. Everyone knew about him. So there was a new yeshiva in Yerushalayim called Oel Moed. That started, it was specifically for Sephardim, and he actually ended up joining the staff at a very young age, at the age of 22. He was already very, very important. This is, yeah. So, there was a problem. World War I broke out, and the Ottomans were pulling everyone in. They were just saying, if you are an able body, we're going to draft you. Rav Ezra Atiyah, his own family, was actually struck. His older brother Yaakov, we mentioned before, was actually drafted into the Ottoman army. And what happened was he was actually killed in World War I. So Rav Ezra, along with, you know, a lot of other rabbis, they ended up running to Cairo. Another book recommendation that I highly suggest, I don't know if anyone has ever read this before, it's really, really excellent. It's called The Man in the White Sharkskin Suit. It gives you a great idea about what the Egyptian Jewish community was like at the time. There's also something, for those people that are Ashkenazi, they don't really understand, first of all, the beauty of the culture, how acculturated and how much of part of society these Sephardim were, but yet still very, very strongly and deeply religious, which is, I mean, it's really, really beautiful. Really beautiful. So, when Rav Ezra Atiyah got there, he started a yeshiva called Ahava Ve'achva. He started this yeshiva.
And he started with Masechet Chulin. Most yeshivot, they either start with Baba Masiya, or they start with Masechet Brachot, but he started with Chulin. Why was he so worried about that? Because with acculturation, it's a very, very fine line to assimilation. And already in Egypt, some of the barriers are breaking down. So he gave so many different shiurim about wine of non-Jews, about cooking of non-Jews. That's really what he started with in order to go help them, and it really made a big, big, big impact. In fact, this is just as an aside, there's a great book, another recommendation, Tradition and Crisis by Professor Jacob Katz. He writes over here that when the Chachamim of Italy during the 16th century allowed wine, what happened right after that was rampant assimilation. That even though they had very, very good proofs, even though they were relying on the Ramah, even though nowadays, most, if you're, especially if you're not Catholic, the wine that you're having isn't, going to be used for transubstantiation, it's not going to be used for Avodah Zarah purposes, maybe it's okay. When they allowed it in Italy, rampant, rampant assimilation, and we all know obviously what happened in America when people became, lax on that. So this leads to the next story. What happened was, is that he was one time giving a shiur in Chulin, and one of the ideas in Chulin, one of the halachot, is something called Shiluach HaKan, or Shiluach HaKan for Ashkenazi, which is all about sending away the mother bird, sending away the mother bird. And they're all discussing it, and Rav Ezra Atiyah is giving a shiur in front of both rabbis and lay people, and he tells a crazy case that's brought in the Gemara. What happens if a bird makes a nest on someone's head? It's a weird case. The Gemara says that. Already you have the Maariv Chiyas. He was someone, very interesting person, who writes that a lot of cases in the Gemara were never ever practical. It was really just for ideas and stuff, in theory. But here, there's someone in the crowd that started saying, Rabbi Atiyah, that's so silly. What's with this Gemara? Talking about an insane case. A bird makes a nest on someone's head. Do you have to do Shiluach HaKain? It doesn't make any sense at all. Just at that point, he had a student that came back from India. And Rav Ezra Atiyah wanted to change the subject for good reason. And he's like, whoa, oh my gosh, my old Talmid, how's it going? How was India? Oh, India was amazing. It was great. Made a lot of money there. Also, I saw the weirdest thing in the entire world. I was going around and I happened to see a yogi. And this person was sitting there and he was meditating. And he meditated for 3 days without moving. On the last day he was there, on top of his head, a bird came and made a nest. Everyone in the crowd couldn't believe it. It's like boom, like better in a movie. Boom, like right after. And everyone saw the chokhmah and saw the greatness of the Gemara and obviously the Sita Dishmaya of Rav Ezra Atiyah. So he returned to Yerushalayim in 1922. And Ol Moed, his former yeshiva, merges with Porat Yosef. Now what exactly is Porat Yosef? There was a great philanthropist. His name was Yosef Shalom. He lived in Calcutta in India. Made a lot of money. And he happened to buy the tract of land overlooking the Kotel. And he wanted to place a hospital there. But who did he consult? He consulted the Ben Ish Chai. Ben Ish Chai said, well, hospital's good. Don't get me wrong. Hospital's good. Fantastic. But there should really be a yeshiva. And they ended up building Yeshiva Porat Yosef, which is named after the Mr. Yosef Shalom. And it became very, very quickly the place where Sephardim could go and learn Torah. The place where it could happen. Only two years into it, the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Shlomo Lanyado, passed away. And Rav Ezra Atiyah was the mashgiach. He was in charge of everyone's spiritual welfare. In fact, he was very musar-oriented. He used to carry around with himself a copy of the Chovot Levavot, or in Ashkenazis, the Chovos HaLevavos. He used to carry it around. In fact, if he was invited to a place that he didn't want to go, he would say, listen, I can go, but I don't really want to bring the Chovos Levavos in there, so I'm not going to go. So he was very musar-oriented. So he was a mashgiach. He was in charge of everyone's spiritual welfare. But only 2 years into yeshiva, Rav Lanyado passed away, and he was raised to be the Rosh Yeshiva. He was named the Rosh Yeshiva. And he was really, really, really good at it. Really good at it. Why is he so good at it? Because almost every single great Sephardic rabbi of this past generation learned by him. I shouldn't say almost. Every single. If you guys are, learning from me, I certainly hope you guys have heard something you never heard before, then you are learning in essence, by Rebbe Atiyah, because a lot of the stuff that I know comes from Rav Ovadia. And he was really, really, he was so good with the students. There was one time, a class clown who would mess up shiur with his jokes and everything. So he one time pulled him over, and he started talking to him. And then this kid told a joke. And Rebbe Atiyah then told a joke. And then it was basically like, not like lip sync battle, but it was like a joke battle. Like they're going back and forth with the jokes. And eventually the student ended up becoming awesome in shiur. And they asked him, they said, how did you become so awesome? He said, I had this meeting with the Rosh Yeshiva. I thought the Rosh Yeshiva was a square. I thought he wasn't so cool. But once I got to spend some time with him, I see he's awesome, and I see rabbis aren't just losers, and I want to be someone that learns Torah just like Rav Ezra Atiyah. He would really spur on his students very, very well. For the long Shabbatot, very, very long Shabbatot, there's tons of time in the afternoon on Shabbat. And he asked the students, he said, how much time do you have to learn? How much time? And they said, well, we learn for an hour, 2 hours. You know, it's hard. You know, you eat chameen. I mean, not cholent. You eat chameen with the egg. Oh, my. You know, you get so tired after. He told him, he said, I challenge you. Learn 7 hours. Learn 7 hours on Shabbat afternoon. That Shabbat afternoon, a whole bunch of students do this marathon learning. They're all so happy about themselves. Come Sunday, and they come to Rebbe Atiyah, and he says, just one Shabbat? I meant it for every Shabbat. He was very, very much boom, pushing them to become better and better. There was a poor boy from Iraq. I mean, this just shows how awesome he was. Poor boy from Iraq who could not afford even the bare essentials. Nothing. Rebbe Atiyah said, take out of my salary. Make sure he has a space in his yeshiva. Make sure he's taken care of. An idea was hatched to give money to students who would cover more ground. Would cover more grand yeshiva. Like I went to a yeshiva called Yeshiva Mir. They're famous for like going through a lot of Gemara over and over. Rav Ezra Atiyah was not such a fan of that. He actually wrote, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moneh Sha'ot. Hashem counts hours, V'lo Moneh Dapim. But Hashem does not count pages. The point is, the quality of your learning should be way more than whatever quantity you have. Also, there was an idea to have public speaking courses in Porat Yosef, and he said he was very against it. Taking any sort of time away from Torah was very much anathema to him. And he compared it to a store. A store has a ginormous, ginormous sign, big advertisement in Times Square, but yet a few goods, nothing in there. However, another spice store that has so many goods and has so much stuff in it, they don't have to advertise because you smell already from the outside. I actually just read recently that Cinnabon, they moved, you know about this? They moved their... Oh, I mean, they're delicious. I haven't had one in like 9 months. But basically, like they moved their ovens from the back to the front because they found that, like, I mean, supposedly Abercrombie, like, also, like, I read this in Bloomberg, that, like, they make it pungent in the stores, you know, psychologically, so you buy it. It's very interesting. So Cinnabon, when they moved it, supposedly 30% more people bought because everyone's out in the mall. And like, oh, man, Cinnabon smells amazing. All right. Moving on. So if you tell me in yeshiva, we're talking about the greatness of former rabbis. And we're talking about the greatness of the former rabbanim. And Rav Ezra Atiyah overheard it. And they're asking him. They say, who's greater? Is the Rambam greater or the Ramban? Who's greater? Rav Ezra Atiyah said, you guys are all Syrians. You guys are all Sephardi. You guys know what a gold scale is. A gold scale is very small. However, what would happen if you put a ginormous boulder on one of these? If you put a boulder on one of these scales, it would be totally shocked. The scale wouldn't work. The same thing by our great rabbis, that it's impossible to go out and weigh them. They are so amazing and so great. There's no way you could at all compare them in the slightest. Yet, in 1948, the Jordanians took over, and this is called People of the Book. One of the things that was promised was going through some of their writings. Rav Ezra Atiyah didn't have any writings. He did not have any writings. The reason why is because the entire library of Porat Yosef, which was amazing and had one-of-a-kind manuscripts, in 1948, along with all of the Kitavim, along with all of the writings of Rav Ezra Atiyah, totally destroyed by the Jordanians. It would not become part of Israel again until 1967. So Rav Ezra Atiyah, it's actually an Aleppan tradition that, like, he viewed it min hashamayim, he viewed it from Hashem, that he shouldn't publish anything, and he actually did not publish anything at all. We only have stuff from his Talmidim. We only have it. So, they actually ended up moving to Geula. They ended up moving to Geula. you know, Mea Sharim, Beis Israel, this whole area, they bought this tract of land along with the Ger Hasidim, and on one side there's Yeshiva Porat Yosef, and the other side is this beautiful Ger Yeshiva. This was the main center of Sephardi learning for a very, very long time. In 1967, when Baruch Hashem, we got back the Ir Atika, one of the very first things that was done, World Jewry was, you know, totally galvanized to go ahead and rebuild Yeshiva Porat Yosef. And that's actually, if you go to the Old City nowadays, you can actually see Porat Yosef, Baruch Hashem, totally rebuilt. But still, this one in Geula, and you can actually see Rav Ezra Atiyah right over here. That's where he is. This actually is like the main branch of Porat Yosef. Like, this is actually the more prestigious one. The one in the Old City, it's a good yeshiva, but it's not nearly, like, you know, when people are like, oh, I went to Porat Yosef, it's really this. Rav Ben Tzion Abba Shaul, who was one of the great tzaddikim, one of the great gedolim, passed away, you know, in the year 2000. Great, great tzaddik. He was actually the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Porat Yosef for a very long time. He wrote three volumes of Sheilot Yeshivot, of Responsa, called Or L'Sion. Tremendous, tremendous rabbi. I have a picture of him later when he's young, which is very cool. When they moved to Geula, they also opened up a like kids wing in Katamon, which is gorgeous, kids wing. And they asked Rav Ezra Atiyah, they had never had dorms before, and this was the very first time that they had dorms. And they asked Rav Ezra Atiyah, what are we supposed to do about Hanukkah? Because before then, all of the students would light at home. Sephardim, the custom amongst Sephardim, is that only one person in the entire household lights. That's it. It doesn't matter if you have 10 people at home. It doesn't make a difference. You light one menorah, and that's it. It's actually the Shita. It's actually the opinion of Tosafot. It's actually Tosfos, which is very interesting. Ashkenazim kind of hold like the Rambam. It's a little bit interesting. So only light one. But what happens to a guy who's dorming? What is he supposed to do? They asked Rav Ezra Atiyah. Rav Ezra Atiyah said, don't ask me. He said, ask my student, Rav Ovadia Yosef. Rav Ovadia Yosef wrote a very lengthy responsa. Part of it is actually still in manuscript form, where he writes that you should, that you could light, but without a beracha. Because Rav Ovadia holds, I actually practiced this when I was learning yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, I am part of my father's household, since my father, Baruch Hashem, was still paying the bills. Thank God. So, not now, but you know. But it was really nice. So what happened was, I was still part, the term is called Somech al Shulchan Aviv, I was still part of my family's household. So therefore my father, even though there was a 7-hour time difference, nevertheless, I did not have to light Hanukkah candles because I'm still part of my father's house. What I did was, because I went to Hakotel before I went to the Mir, I wanted people to, you know, not think I was a goy and like not lighting Hanukkah menorah. You know, so what I did was, is that I lit it without a beracha. And that's exactly what Rav Ovadia writes. However, even though Rav Ezra Atiyah deferred to a student very often, there are other things where he did not defer to Rav Ovadia for. And that's why I gave you on page 2, the Hebrew. Don't look at it inside, but I gave it to you anyway. It's from Rav Shimon Badani, where he says that Rav Ezra Atiyah was very, very against the Heter Mechira. Heter Mechira is selling land during Shavuot to Arabs, and they own it for that year, and therefore work could continue being done. Rav Ovadia was one of the main proponents of the Heter Mechira, and even up until his death, he said the Heter Mechira is still fine, it's not a problem, and he was very, very clear about that. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was also a big proponent of it, unfortunately, in the newest editions of Shavuot, of Mincha Shlomo, his son actually took out the places where his father allowed the Heter Mechira, because nowadays, very unfortunately, the Heter Mechira, it's all in politics, that if you believe in Heter Mechira, it means that you're Tzioni, and if you're against Heter Mechira, it means you're Haredi. Unfortunately, it's very problematic. But Rav Ovadia said, Heter Mechira is absolutely fine, not a problem at all, even though Rav Ezra Atiyah totally, totally disagreed. When Rav Ovadia Yosef was very young, when he was very young, already like 16, 17, Rav Ezra Atiyah told him, he said, I want you to give shiurim. I want you to go give classes around the community. And Rav Ovadia started giving classes. And if you know anything about Rav Ovadia, he was a major akshan. He's very, very stubborn. And he believed very strongly in the Beit Yosef, or Yosef Cairo, the 16th century great rabbi from Sfat, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, very strongly against the Ben Ish Chai. We mentioned before, Ben Ish Chai passed away in 1909. For a short time there, for about 30-something years, a little bit longer, the Ben Ish Chai was the de facto posek for all of Sephardic Jewry. However, Rav Ovadia, even at this young age, he says, no, what are you talking about? The Ben Ish Chai, we actually spoke about this last year, the Ben Ish Chai is very, very much influenced by Kabbalah. He said, absolutely asur. If you guys remember, Rabbi Moskowitz, actually, I was here, it was awesome. He spoke about the Radbaz. The Radbaz has a teshuvah that says that when we paskin, when we actually decide halacha, we don't consider Kabbalah. That's not something that we look at. So Ben Ish Chai, you are not the posek. Rav Yosef Cairo, who very, very rarely ever quotes Kabbalah, even though he was a major Kabbalist, in the Shulchan Aruch, he said, we must hold like Maran Shulchan Aruch, and he would actually give these shiurim. You could imagine what people thought about that. You're talking about this little, you know, 17-year-old person saying, oh my gosh, the Ben Ish Chai is not who should follow. People got very, very upset. It got so bad that people were threatening to beat him up. It was really, really bad. And he was saying, maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I shouldn't be going against the Ben Ish Chai. Who came and defended him? Rezatia said, whatever you do, don't bow to their pressure, continue giving the shiurim. And right now, you could buy an 8-volume set called Halichot Olam, written by Rav Ovadia, a whole perush. Every single page is against the Ben Ish Chai, showing how the Ben Ish Chai is not the normative of halacha. Even though don't get me wrong, he has a tremendous amount of respect for the Ben Ish Chai, nevertheless, he did not feel like that you should pasuk like the Ben Ish Chai. When I was, just I'll add this in a little bit, when I was a little kid, my mom on Shabbat, she used to read me from the Ben Ish Chai. So I used to think that was like straight up normative halacha. So it took me like a long time to like stop doing all the Ben Ish Chai stuff and then start doing the Rav Ovadia stuff. But yeah, my mom's a tzaddikah. She's amazing. What else? In 1947, and this is the picture, one of the best pictures. I love it. I love it. You see the fez on Rav Ovadia's head. It's so cool. Rav Ovadia was sent in 1947 to the community of Egypt. It was reeling really, really badly. Once again, I refer to a man in the white shark skin suit. You see, things were really bad. People were fleeing. People were going to Paris. People were going to Morocco. People were going anywhere else. Anywhere else. Going to America. People were leaving Egypt in droves. And the spiritual level of the community was falling. So Rav Ezra said, hey, I gotta help out. Who does he send? He sends his top tamid. He sends Rav Ovadia. This was very, very important in the formation of Rav Ovadia, and it was very formative for him. That, like, it gave him the backbone. I mean, he had the backbone before, but here he was threatened to be killed. Here, the Egyptian authorities were constantly thinking he's a spy for Israel, which was funny because he was only into Torah. Things were really, really bad, but it gave him a tremendous, tremendous amount of strength that he would show later on. Rav Ovadia, yeah, let's see. Oh, this is a picture. This is great. These are three Talmidim of Rav Ezra Atiyah. On the far left is Rav Yaakov Yosef, who actually passed away before his father, Rav Ovadia. He was very interesting. He became a Chabad Chassid. He, not Mashiachist, but he believed in Lubavitcher Rebbe. Very, very, I mean, big Tami Chacham. I actually heard him before he passed away. His father, Rav Ovadia, with the beard. In the middle is Rav Ben Sion Abba Shaul. As you know, there's no beard, no Sephardim, not a problem. And then on the very, very far right, that's Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. He became the chief rabbi of the state of Israel after Rav Ovadia during the late 70s, early 80s. Rav Ezra Atiyahu was a very honest person. He had his Kitav Smicha for his students. And a certain student needed to get his Smicha. He needed to get his rabbinic ordination. And written on it, right after they got kicked out of Yerushalayim in 1948, written on these things, it said, signed in the old city, Iratika, signed. Rezatia said, I can't sign this. It's not right, man. It's not right. So what did he do? He snuck into Jordanian territory with the smicha, signed it in the old city, and ran back out because he did not want to be caught. But that's how much he was dedicated to truth. Now let's go on to Ashkenazim. How did Ashkenazim view him? Now this really should take us until the end. Now, as we mentioned before, the primary Lithuanian gadol was the Chazon Ish. It was the Chazon Ish. And the Chazon Ish, when he would visit the Kotel, he would always make a stop to Rav Ezra Atiyah, always talk Torah with him. He actually stood up for him when he entered a room. Big deal. Very, very big deal, because we're talking about the quintessential Lithuanian Gadol, probably in Israel, the most influential rabbi of the 20th century. A lot of what we have nowadays, a lot of this very, very strong Haredi influence very much comes from the Chazon Ish, which is fascinating because he really did not have that many students. One of those students was, you know, the dear departed who I miss very much, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, who was a tremendous, tremendous resource who I learned a tremendous amount from. So the Chazon Ish was one time visiting the Kotel, and he goes and he visits Ezra Atiyah, and they have a whole conversation. The Chazon Ish was leaving, and he told one of his students, he said, talking to Rav Ezra is like talking to one of the Rishonim. And the student was like, oh, come on. Like, you hear this type of hyperbole all the time. He's like, no. This is like talking to one of the Rishonim, like talking to one of the earlier commentators. Very, very, very strong stuff. So strong that Rav Ben Tzion Abba Shaul, who's the middle over here, he went to go visit the Chazon Ish one time, and he's sitting and learning in Bnei Brak, and a whole bunch of students start surrounding him, and they're looking at him. And you know, it's not like a zoo. He's like, yo, what's going on? We're like, why are you guys looking at me? He said, the Chazon Ish said, we have to watch you learn because you guys are students of a Rishon. You guys are students of one of the early great, great rabbis. Well, there's a lot to learn from you. However, not everything is so rosy. Let's get back to this Sefer, which I really, really don't like. Okay, all right. This is found. Is awesome. It's found in this article by Zvi Zohar, by Professor Zvi Zohar. So in Aleppo, if you take a look at page two in your Mama Koma sheet, it says Aleppo, City of Scholars, Art School 2005, is on page 133. This is a quote. The Moazeh Gedolei HaTorah, the group of top Torah scholars of the generation, would meet regularly to discuss matters of the Jewish community at large. The group mostly spoke in Yiddish. Although he didn't understand the language, Rav Ezra would attend these meetings. I get spiritually uplifted to see all the great rabbis together, he would explain. Oh my. There's a lot of issues with this, If you take a look at the quote, it says, Moazeh Gedolei HaTorah, the group of top Torah scholars. Top Torah scholars according to who? According to the Agudat Yisrael. That's a political movement. These were just people. I mean, I'm not saying they're not great Talmidei Chachamim, but they... In no sheep or form were these people known to be like the top rabbis in the entire world. Not to mention, these top rabbis, and this is something that when I first read this in the original book, it really like stung me a little bit, especially as a Sephardi, I'm very sensitive to this type of stuff. Like, what? Like, Ezra Tiaz is great Gadol. He's a great Tzaddik. They're not going to change their language? They're all sitting around talking Yiddish. But yet no one has, you know, the fortitude to change the language. No one has like the chesed, I'm trying to think, you know, no one has like that type of sensitivity to change the language. You have one of the greatest rabbis in the entire world sitting right here, but yet you're just going to continue talking Yiddish. It's very, very problematic. And not to mention, Rav Ezra Tiaz, his time was so precious to him. And what bothers me about this is that it's and he shows this person, Zvi Zohar, shows this about this book, is that it's really part of a general trend where basically, like, what is good? Good is Lithuanian Gedolim. By the very fact that Ezra sat by these Lithuanian Gedolim and didn't even understand a word and looked up to them so much, it shows that that's what's right. That was never in... Oh my, it's just so... It just bothers me so much. And I'm going to make it even stronger. I'm not going to turn this off, but like, it could. I one time heard in a shiur by Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef a story. I'm only going to tell the story because he told the story, but like it really needs to be said. It's very important. That one time, his father, Rabbi Avad Yosef, told the story that him and Rabbi Ezra Tiaz went to one of these Moazeh Gedolei HaTorah. They went to one of these things, and everyone's talking in Yiddish. So Rabbi Avad, you know, he's next to Rabbi Ezra Tiaz, and he leans over to Rav Shach. He says, Rav Shach, do you mind like changing the language? The way Rav Yitzchak Yosef says it is that Rav Shach turned around and continued conversing in Yiddish. The point is that I think that you guys could see that the story as told in Aleppo, I most certainly don't think that it happened that way. And especially for those of us who grew up, you know, Sephardi and stuff like that, like it's something that like I don't want to be told who my great Tzaddikim. I don't want to be told that, you know, this book, for example, goes against Zionism, for example, which these great Sephardi rabbis were very for, were very much for. Rav Matlub Abadi, who we quoted before, great Zionist. That's one major thing, and secular learning is another thing. These great rabbis of Aleppo, they actually valued secular learning. And the problem is, if you were just some, you know, yeshiva bacher buying this book, you would say, wow, oh my gosh, you know, my tradition is to be against secular learning, to be against the state of Israel, and all of this different type of stuff, which, you know, absolutely has no previous Sephardi paradigm. However, Rav Ezra was a tremendous anav. Even with all of this, even though, you know, I don't think that story is true, but one time a student came over to him after Rav Ezra Tiaz had gone and met the Ger Rebbe, and Rav Ezra said it was such a zechut to meet the Ger Rebbe, the Beis Yisrael, it was such a zechut to meet him, it was so great, it was so amazing. So the student says, don't you think it was a zechut to the Beit Yisrael that he met you? So Rav Ezra got so upset, and he said, I'm a nothing, I'm a nobody, no way, chas v'shalom. He got very upset. The student absolutely changed his ways. Rav Ezra's wife was also a tzedekah, she was amazing, her name was Bolisa, she was the daughter of a great tzaddik also. So she, one time, she had a dress that needed to be made. It had to be tailored. She brought it over to the seamstress. And the seamstress, you know, went ahead and did it. And a week later, Rav Ezra Atiyah's wife goes to go pick it up. And in the middle of the conversation, the seamstress says, I'm marrying off a daughter in a week, and unfortunately, I don't even have a dress for my own daughter. And it's very sad that I'm, you know, sewing tons of dresses, but like, you know, my own daughter doesn't have a dress. Rebbe Simbolisa, what did she do? She went ahead and she gave her dress right then and there and said, no, I don't want it, you take it. But that's not the end of the story. Bolisa goes back home and she says, Rebbe Ezra Atiyah, I did such a great mitzvah. You know what he said? He said, did you pay her for the pest alterations that you just made? And oh my gosh, totally slipped my mind. She went back and she actually paid the money for the alterations. That's how much he was committed to truth. That's how much. The greatness of Rav Ezra Atiyah, the greatness of him was his Talmidim. Great rabbis like Rav Ovadia, who absolutely changed all world Jewry. Like I mentioned before, it's not just a once in a generation gadol. He was once in a generation's gadol. Whatever you want to say about his politics, which I'm not getting into, we spoke way too much about that last time. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was one of his Talmidim. Rav Yehuda Tzadko ended up succeeding him in the yeshiva. Rav Ben Sion Abbas Shaul, the great Posek, the great Tzaddik, amazing. Rav Baruch Ben Chaim, who ended up leading the Jewish community in Brooklyn. Rav Chaim David Alevi, who Rabbi Mark Angel loves because he was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, has awesome psakim, very, very big Zionist. And someone who I actually learned by, Rav Elio Ben Chaim, who is a Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva University, he also learned by Rav Ezra Atiyah, and they all attest to his greatness. And a whole generation, like this is like everybody. Like if you ever meet a Sephardi rabbi, it is very, very likely that they learned and they could absolutely attribute their, you know, anything that they have is all to Rav Ezra Atiyah. Like we mentioned before, he had no writing, so therefore it all comes through the Talmidim. He had a stroke, and the thing that really bothered him so much, less than the pain, and the pain was great. The pain was so bad, there was a great Kabbalist, he passed away in 1986, his name was Rav Yisrael Abuchasera, the Baba Sali. The Baba Sali came to visit him, and he told those around, he said that Rav Ezra Atiyah is accepting upon himself the pain of the generation, he's doing it in order to redeem this generation. I don't know what that means, but that's what he said about Rav Ezra Atiyah. He was in a tremendous amount of pain, but what pained him even more than that, is that when he got sick, some families came through the woodwork, and it turns out that he was actually supporting them. And when he got sick, he couldn't support them anymore. And they came like, yo, Rav Ezra, how's it going? Oh my gosh, like I can't believe it. And eventually, you know, people found out about his, you know, about his sikut. He actually died on Lag Ba'Omer, which is, you know, the day after Lag Ba'Omer. That's the day that Sephardim can finally shave. That's the day. And that's exactly when he passed away. Yehi Zichro Baruch. He was a tremendous tzaddik. I certainly hope that I, you know, gave you guys a good idea of you know, the influence that he had. And Bezrat Hashem, we should all, you know, see Mashiach Sikenu, Bezrat Hashem, very, very soon.